You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Tim Hulbert and Tom Olivier presented very different views as to the direction our community should take. Listen as they discuss the likely consequence of their positions on the physical environment, taxpayers, local businesses, and job seekers. The debate took place at the Wednesday, March 11, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by CEO and managing partner of The Bridge Limited, Grant Tate. SSE President Bob McGrath introduced the program. Our podcast is entitled Albemarle County, Growth versus No Growth. Here's Bob McGrath.
So we have a debate, and our debaters, I think we can all understand, are eminently qualified to represent these starkly opposing views of growth versus no growth for the community. Now, I want to introduce our two debaters, and I also want to introduce again to you the man who will moderate the debate. Tim Hulbert is the president and CEO of the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce. The chamber has more than 1,100 members and affiliates that together employ 45,000 people in our region. Tim is a native of upstate New York. He holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in government from Manhattan College. Prior to coming to Charlottesville, he held a similar position with the Chamber of Commerce with the Rensselaer County Regional Chamber of Commerce in New York. Before that, he served on executive staffs of the New York State Transportation Commissioners and also the Energy Commissioner. Here in Virginia, he's active in the Virginia Association of Chamber of Commerce Executives. He's served on its board of directors and also as its president. He's also served on the board of directors of the Virginia Chamber of Commerce. Tom Olivier is president of ASAP, Advocates for a Sustainable Albemarle Population. This is a nonprofit membership organization that was incorporated in 2002. Now, ASAP's website overarching statement reads in part, ASAP was formed by Central Virginians who believe that Albemarle County and neighboring communities should begin work immediately to achieve a stationary population size in the foreseeable future. Our goal is to gradually slow and ultimately stop growth before it consumes our environment and further erodes our quality of life. Tom grew up in New Orleans. He moved to Albemarle in 1981. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in biology from Tulane and a PhD in biological anthropology from Duke. He completed a postdoctoral fellowship in theoretical biology at the University of Sussex. Tom has been a member of Citizens for Albemarle, the Thomas Jefferson Sustainability Council, the Albemarle County Natural Heritage Committee, and past chair of the Piedmont Group of the Sierra Club. Currently, he builds computer models of primate populations and raises sheep on his Albemarle farm. Presumably, he doesn't model that. Now, to help keep our debate moving along on a civilized high plane, we're fortunate to have as our moderator Grant Tate. He's the CEO and managing partner of The Bridge Limited, a Charlottesville consulting company that helps leaders make difficult decisions. Many of us heard Grant's presentation to this group, to Senior Statesmen of Virginia, in January, where his title was Bridging the Gap, Listening to People You Don't Want to Hear. Maybe this is very appropriate to today's program. Grant Tate, will you take over?
Thanks so much, and it's good to see you all again, and we're looking forward to a lively discussion. We have set some ground rules for the meeting today, and I'd just like to take a minute to go over those. We will have opening statements from each person, and we've set a maximum of 15 minutes for that. And I brought my stopwatch so we can measure that accurately, and then we'll give If it gets to 14 minutes, I'll give the speaker a one-minute warning. Then after that, each person will have a chance to ask the other a question, and then that other person can respond, and then a counter response, and then a response. So back and forth, back and forth. So each person gets a chance to ask one question and then a discussion therein. And then we'll, at the end, we'll have a summary statement of 4 minutes. And after those summary statements, you'll have a chance to raise your questions. And we've asked that you write your questions on 3x5s. And so we'll pass those around so you can write them. I'm, Terry Cooper has gratefully said he would read the writing and help us interpret those, so but try to write legibly if you can. And then after the Q&A, we'll have a short summary of the meeting. So everybody on board with this, with the arrangement?
So Grant, Terry and I will be around here with cards. Okay.
Okay, the other thing I would like to ask is that I found out that generally people in our age group put that ringer a little louder than the teenagers do. So if you brought your phone, I'd appreciate if you would put it on mute or turn the ringer off or turn the phone off. So we're going to ask Mr. Olivier to start with his opening 15 minutes. Thank you.
Well, first, thanks very much to Graham for the introduction, and I want to take a moment to thank everyone involved in the Senior Statesman for inviting us here today, especially Terry Cooper, who took the lead in this. ASAP, which is my organization, we represent in part the Purple Polygon in the center of the map. We also consider the city of Charlottesville, the dot in the center, to be our home base. We see ASAP in Charlottesville. We see Albemarle in Charlottesville as being in most ways a functional single community despite the governmental differences. And we think that a lot of topics need to be discussed in public. We think there's been a history of this in our community, and we greatly appreciate a chance that the Senior Statesman is providing us to come talk about a topic like this, which many find controversial, and frankly, many don't really want to take the time or don't wish to confront. Let me begin with no fooling around with what we represent, ASAP's right size proposal. We believe that a finite size population compatible with environmental protection and a high quality of life should be sought by our community. We've asked the city and county to identify the right size for our community by an open public process and then refer to it, for example, in development of planning processes, planning policies, and making planning decisions. And ASAP's right size proposal to open the discussion, we've just thrown out the suggestion that the right size for the combined Albemarle-Charlottesville community would be about 165,000. Now, that's not based on any algorithm. We may even want to change it a bit after discussion, but to open the discussion, we want to say, might not that be a good size for us? Whoops, sorry, I've got to master this. Okay. I'm sorry, I guess I got ahead one. Our assumptions are that the population of a finite area cannot expand endlessly. There are limits. We can wait for external events to limit us, wars, disease, starvation, or for local areas, locality may simply become unattractive, for example, parts of the Rust Belt perhaps. Or we can choose to encourage a stable right size actively. We can decide for ourselves to try to rationally decide what should be the size of our community and then implement policies and individual decisions to support that. And again, this was the right size proposal. We suggest we develop an estimate of this by an open process, and we've thrown out the idea of 165,000. I'm sorry, I keep going the wrong way on this. Now, there are different kinds of reasons why we think we need to identify a finite right size. One involves sort of the biological, the ecological, the sustainability issue. ASAP a few years ago did some research, in part with support from both the city and the county, to look into what was sort of the biological capacity of our landscape and the ability to support people. One of the things we found was that there was an ecological footprint study, and we found at the size that we had achieved just a few years ago, some 3.7 Albemarle Charlottesville landscapes would be needed to provide the biological productivity that our population consumes if we live like average Americans. We also hit an analysis of the impact of growth on ecosystem services. Now, ecosystem services are quite diverse, but they include things like water purification, air purification by biological systems, pollination services by bees and other sorts of insects. There's quite a range of them. Our study focused in on a few like carbon sequestration, water quality, and air quality preservation. And it was very simple. Basically, it showed that as growth occurs, ecosystem services degrade, and largely they're protected in areas under open space easements, but wherever we have growth, they tend to go downhill, and we need them to stay alive. We're human beings, we're mammals. The ecological reasons continued. Water quality, a few years ago, Streamwatch locally did a study of the impact of population density on water quality in different sub-watersheds of the Rivanna River Basin. A few years later, we extended it using Streamwatch data that they made available to us, but it was more extended than the original study. Our study was pretty similar to theirs. We found, here's a graph of water quality in the vertical axis and population density on the horizontal. And what it shows is that water quality in the sub-watersheds of our Albemarle landscape in the Rivanna River Basin, actually, declines quite sharply as you start have people occupying the landscape, as you start adding houses. And the one at the bottom I'll just mention is loss of biological diversity. And this is sort of derivative of some of the things I've already said. As you build houses in the rural areas, as you lose land to development, and over the last 10 or so years, we've averaged about 200 new houses per year in the rural areas. Now, it varies with time depending on the economy. But if that's allowed to continue, we will continue to lose rural areas, ecosystems, and the biological resources that they support. There are quality of life reasons, though, changing gear to something, a different kind of concern, one that perhaps is closer to most people. With population growth, you can expect more stop-and-go traffic, loss of open space amenities. That's the kind of pleasant side of all the biological resources that also keep us alive, and a loss of a sense of place. New development is often of the anywhere USA type, large-scale new buildings where you had small ones. You have displacement of existing residences and small businesses. And if you think I'm talking about Charlottesville right now, yes, I am. Local economic reasons. ASAP did a cost of growth study and found that the break-even price from a point of view of providing tax revenue to the government compared to the cost that a new residence entails was about twice the average price of a house in Albemarle County. If you go to the budget hearings, which have been going on, if you went to them last year, you'll find that the county is proposing raising taxes again. And what's driving this is predominantly the need to expand public safety, police, fire and rescue, expansion of public schools for more kids, and water quality protection plan. The water quality protection plan is in part to deal with the impacts of growth on water quality in the past. But our budgets are increasing, and it's fundamentally driven by the need to expand police schools and so on to serve the new population, the expanded population. County Executive Tom Foley will say that quite frankly. And I wanted to cite a general economic finding. Eben Fodor, who's a consultant who looks at growth issues, did a study a couple of years ago, and there's a mistake I need to point out here. He examined the relationship between rate of growth and economic prosperity in 100 metro areas. I noticed last night I put 200. It's 100 different largest metropolitan areas in the U.S. It's about 200 million people that live in those. And that quote at the bottom is from the abstract. The study finds that that faster growth rates are associated with lower incomes, greater income declines in the recent recession, and higher poverty rates. He also separated the fastest growing from the lowest growing. 25 metro areas and compared them. The average per capita income in the slowest growing was about $8,000 higher than in the fastest growing. The slowest growing had a growth rate near about 0.1%, which is to say there were near stable population size. So empirically, the idea that you grow or die economically doesn't seem to be the case. And in fact, here we have what are near stable populations seeming to be relatively prosperous. Ecological economics, there are many who say we have to grow. I just alluded to that. There's a whole branch of economics now called ecological economics, and it's focused on trying to understand steady-state, stable-sized economies. It assumes that economies are embedded in surrounding ecosystems, and it insists that the inputs of materials from the ecosystems into economies and the output of pollutants from economies has to be examined explicitly if you're going to talk about developing sustainable economies. In a sense, it talks about recognizing the existence of that we now live in a full world when a lot of the sort of current economic thinking was developed and it sort of began after World War II. There were only 2+ billion people in the world. Now we have 7. And there's a question of whether we can support even the current number. There's an idea of recognition of enough that we all need to understand the globe's finite resources are finite, and we have to be satisfied with enough. If you subscribe to the view that he who dies with the most toys wins, you probably wouldn't be happy in a steady state economy. And a well-known pioneer in this field, ecological economics, is Herman Daly. I'll just mention him. Now, the means of population stabilization, sometimes people say to us, you want a Chinese-style birth limitation program. Oh, so you're going to put a gate across 29 and so on. Which of my 5 children do you want? Which 3 do you want me to drown? That kind of thing. But in fact, there are 2 parts of population growth that we have to think about. One is births versus deaths, and the other is in-migration versus out-migration. Regularly, developed countries around the world, without any kind of coercion, move to birth rates that are below replacement as a result of individual decision by women and men that it's in our interest to have fewer children. Right now, Japan and Italy are like that. We've achieved that in time, or we've left it, but we've been at that point in the past. Many countries go below go below replacement rates without anybody trying to force them to do it. Also, you have in-migration dampening, and this is important in the city right now. If you limit upzonings of development areas, and for example in the city, if you don't upzone neighborhoods to allow big new apartment buildings, you're not going to have growth taking place in those neighborhoods. In the open spaces out in Albemarle County in the rural areas, everybody seems to love easements, which are conservation easements. These are permanent agreements not to develop your land. In Virginia, quite admirably, it's possible to get some significant tax credits if you do that. And all sorts of people of all sorts of political persuasion like easements. So we have, right now, readily mechanisms for stabilizing our population growth without resort to any kind of coercion or any sort of un-American freedom-constraining proposals or activities. It's not as hard as some people seem to assume. And this is the challenge before us. We know that endless population growth and economic growth are impossible. You run out of space, you run out of stuff, you just can't keep growing. We know that growth is costly from a dollar point of view. Look at the budgets. And we know we're degrading our environment. That's it's plain as day. We know, too, that we have the ready means to encourage population stability. So the question is, are we prepared to seek a population stable size? And we hope some of you, before the end of today, will come to the conclusion that at least you are as individuals and you'll want to help work toward that goal. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom. And Tim, you can sit at the table or you can come here, whichever you prefer.
I like walking.
Okay. This is Mr. Tim Holbert.
Thank you, Grant, and thank you,
senior statesmen and women of Virginia. My name is Tim Hulbert, and I work for the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce. We were founded in 1913. If you look at some of my learned debaters' graphics in his book, you'll see that 1913 was a long time ago. Along the way, first off, our mission has never changed. We use slightly different words, but we're dedicated, love that word, to representing private enterprise, promoting business, and enhancing the quality of life in our greater Charlottesville communities. 1917, we founded the Red Cross in Central Virginia. 1943, we founded what is today the United Way. 1947 to 55, because things take a little while in our community, we advocated and saw the construction of the airport. In 1959, we came up with an idea that perhaps it would make some sense to have a pedestrian mall on some of the blocks on Main Street. And in true Charlottesville speed, in 1973, it opened. 1970, we were the lead advocate in the community for a little thing called Piedmont Virginia Community College. We also established the Charlottesville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau and advocated for a road, which I refer to as the Crosstown Bypass. You all know it as US 250. In the 90s, we helped set up the Central Virginia Partnership for Economic Growth. And a few months ago, we opened a road that we first began talking about in 1967, and in absolute Charlottesville clock. 48 years later, we now have the John Warner Parkway. And then in the last couple of years, we have been pretty focused on job growth, not overall so much, but for that part of our community, our neighbors who struggle, who do not have the financial attainment that many of us in this room have, and do not have the social structure that we are so blessed to have. They've been left behind in a national and global economy, and we believe it's our business to try and lift everybody up. John F. Kennedy said, "A rising tide raises all boats." That's true. It doesn't hurt to help to have the boat not full of water when you're doing that. So the question here, as you can see, our chamber has been involved with many, many things that you and I, we all benefit from. It's real world action. It's day in, day out, grind it out, do the right thing for this community. And that has been premised on the fact that growth makes sense. So the question here today is to grow or not to grow. Or as Mel Brooks might say, to grow or not to grow, that is the question. I think it also premises what's your outlook. Are you fundamentally optimistic, and chambers of commerce are, I am, or are you fundamentally fearful? And I'm not, and our chamber is not. So that really is a question. Let me ask a question of the audience. How many people in this room were born in Charlottesville or Albemarle? Raise your hand. Yeah. How many people grew up in Charlottesville and Albemarle? People who were born here, keep your hands up. Okay. So how many people like me and Tom chose to come to Charlottesville by actions later in your lives? Raise your hand. Yeah. Okay. It's interesting that we're debating growth. we believe, and I believe, I've had a very, very fortunate life and a very fortunate career in doing lots of different things, working in government, outside of government, chambers of commerce, in business, et cetera. But something that's come through, I think we can all grasp the notion that a community, a vibrant community, is fundamentally a living organism. A living organism, and you need to nurture it, and you need to care for it to maintain and enhance that organism. All living organisms basically have three statuses, they are either growing, or they are declining, or they are stasis in the middle. And what my learned opponent suggests is that stasis is a good thing. You could look it up in the dictionary, and you'll see different expressions for it. It's a Greek word, and it basically means staying where you are. This community has not stayed where it has been for the last 150 years, and it is not our intention at the Chamber of Commerce, or mine in my own personal and professional life, is to let that. There is future. There is a future. There is optimism. If you look at some of the numbers, and I like the fact that ASAP suggests that Charlottesville and Albemarle are one community, because, in fact, it is one community. But there's very different demographics at work. In 1980, the population of the city of Charlottesville, excluding students, and very few people, Rich knows, that University of Virginia, in spite of how it looks, it's actually in Albemarle County. The population of the city of Charlottesville is 40,000. In 2010, it was 44,000, just under 44,000. That's a 0.3% growth per year. Albemarle County was 55,000, and in 2010, it was 99,000. And that's 2.6% growth per year. It slowed a little bit in the last 7 or 8 years. That shouldn't surprise anybody, where we've come through a recession and a tepid recovery. There are 115,000 jobs in our greater Charlottesville region. Charlottesville, Albemarle, Fluvanna, Greene, Nelson, Louisa, and Orange. 115,000. We measure that, and we produce a document every year, the Chamber Jobs Report. 50,000 of those jobs are located, not where the worker is, but where the employer is, are located in Albemarle County. 36,000 in the city of Charlottesville. In 2003, I wish I brought a tissue. If anybody has some tissues, want to help me. there were 42,000. So it's 8,000 additional jobs located in Albemarle. Charlottesville had 35,000, about 1,000. And the private sector is fundamentally unchanged. Thank you so much. Boy, everybody's helping me now. Thank you. Great. So when I do speak at a wedding or a funeral, because I'm Irish and I'm not telling any Irish jokes today, I tend to get emotional. My wife says, "Take Kleenex with you." This looks like the generic type. So. Anyway, so that's it's very interesting that we have added in Charlottesville and Albemarle about 9,000 jobs in the last decade. Not a big number when you consider that there's almost 20,000 students in Charlottesville and Albemarle school districts. Now they don't all graduate in 1 year, not yet. but about 2,000 or more, when you throw in the graduation rates at the private schools, 2,000 or more of our young people graduate and are planning on a future. Some go to college, many do, some do not. Where are they going to work? Well, you can go to Richmond, you can go to Lynchburg. We need to, as a community, embrace that kind of growth, that we can have our children and our grandchildren can get the same kind of life that we have been blessed with. My parents and grandparents worked so I could have a better life. And there was opportunity where I lived. I came here because I chose to come here. Our economy is not really generating that kind of opportunity for the next generation. Nationally, in Virginia, and locally. That's what we are about. When we talk about growth, we talk about economic growth. And we believe that is key to our future. We are optimistic about it. We are not fearful. We know that growth brings challenges and it brings problems. But having come from Troy, New York, in a place that has been in decline for a half a century, although it's rebounded recently, I can tell you that the challenges and the problems of growth are far, far better than the challenges and problems of decline and stasis. And with that, I will stop looking at my notes.
Thank you very much to both of you. We'll now enter the second stage, and as I'm talking here, Tim, I'd like for you to ask the first question, and you can be formulating that while I talk here for a few minutes. What we're going to ask you now is if you have a question to write down, then we have 3x5s being passed out, and please write your question on the 3x5, and we will collect those for the stage after this. And so just as a reminder that each of the speakers will now have a chance to ask the other a question, and that person being asked the question will respond, and then it will go back and forth twice. So, Tim, would you like to ask the first question?
Tom, I think one of your slides up there suggested that population growth drives a higher taxes and a higher demand on governmental services. I believe that there's some merit to that. Could you explain why the city of Charlottesville, which essentially has not grown, has a tax rate of 95 cents per $100, and Albemarle County's functionally is actually about 68 cents, because 10 cents on every dollar in Albemarle County is a check that gets written from Albemarle County to the city of Charlottesville, and that's another debate for another day. But could you explain why the no-growth community has a much higher tax rate, 28% higher than Albemarle County?
Well, okay, first say I live in southern Albemarle County, but I have some familiarity with the city and its politics. And there are two things that strike me as likely mechanisms. One, Larry Sabato once declared that Charlottesville was a little bit of central Massachusetts dropped into central Virginia. And it's clearly there's a very strong democratic kind of philosophy, which is much more of an activist government philosophy, or a belief that government should be active and should do lots of things, whereas Albemarle County is kind of touch and go. If you look at results of presidential elections, it's much more, I'd say, tight-fisted about its thinking about what government should do with money. But the other thing, I think like a lot of urban areas, Charlottesville seems to have, and I don't know the exact numbers, but Charlottesville seems to have a large low-income population, and I think the city fathers and mothers think that there need to be expenditures made to look after those, whereas out in Albemarle County, it's I would think, a lower proportion of the population.
I think you are correct about the poverty in the city of Charlottesville, which is why we created that Charlottesville Works Initiative. Interestingly, the Charlottesville Works Initiative identified that 3,000 families are below self-sufficiency within the city of Charlottesville. And while it's a smaller percentage, there are 2,000 families, households, families, not students, in the city of Charlottesville. There are 3,000 families in Albemarle County, and that includes not only the urban core, but rural poverty, which we all know can be invisible to the naked eye and to the political eye. But your response is the problem with Charlottesville is too many Democrats.
No. I'm saying it's if I'm answering that question, that counts as a question.
I was just short-circuiting what you said.
I'm saying it's a different philosophy, and it's interesting to me. But I think that Democrats do see a larger, proper role for government than do many people on the political right. And for example, I mean, I mean, may I keep responding?
You can keep going.
Yeah. Okay, sure. If we look at the county budget right now, what you're seeing is we had a shift a few years ago to a Republic or a conservative majority. There was a lot of tax rate cutting. There was a lot of deferring of expenditures of certain types. There was a great deal of scaling back, for example, of staff in departments like community development. We still have a greatly reduced staff situation in things like the planning department, and the supervisors who are there now are, I would say bravely, the majority anyway, proposing for a tax increase to bring back, not only to provide the new police officers, which the county executive says, we already have a relatively high ratio of citizens to police. If we're not going to slip further, we have to add X many officers. This year they added X many officers. Last year we have to add X many. We've got, I think it's about 200 teachers, 200 students a year that are added to the Albemarle County school system. We have to add some more teachers for that. We have to, at times, add more schools. And then, for example, social services, which deals with a lot of low-income people. Right now, the social service department in Albemarle County is, in terms of caseload to staffers, it's running. I saw Tom Foley, the executive's presentation, about 163% the designed rate. So the county is actually having to raise taxes right now to deal with all these things that derive from population growth. And I mentioned the water quality issue. As you probably know, there are these things called TMDLs that have become a concern in local localities in Virginia because of decisions at a federal level have declared that local governments with water quality problems must develop plans to protect their water quality. The state has passed on unfunded mandates to localities to develop plans to protect or to upgrade water quality to deal with these problems that derived, in fact, from population growth in the past, changes on our landscape, loss of ecosystem services.
Okay. Now, Tom, you have a chance for your question.
Sure. One of the things I'd like to ask Tim, and it's something I've noted many times when I've heard advocates of the business community speak, we hear about the importance of growth to providing jobs, to being exciting, vibrant. I mean, that's a very common word. Now, we want vibrant community here. And I mean, I have no doubt that at times by promoting growth in the short run, one can create some new jobs. One can create prosperity, certainly in some sense, in the short run. But what I really, and you mentioned that the problems of growth are very small compared to the problems of being stable or static. But the thing that concerns environmentalists, and I think that's driving many of us, is that the world's human population has changed so much that the philosophical point of view that was benign and useful after World War II, that we still live in an unfold planet, we still have lots of room to grow. There are less, but there are still frontiers in the world we can move to and consume. But we've moved to a point now where the global human population may be in overshoot in terms of what we can provide for the human race, and the global human population is supposed to continue growing, and things that were okay 50 years ago growth-wise cause burdens on the ability of the planet to sustain us.
Tom, as Diane Rehm would say, what's the question?
Okay.
I was thinking the same thing. I was waiting.
Sorry, I was framing
the question. So what do you think about that, Tom?
Yeah.
The question is, does the business community see any constraints on the championing of growth that have to be recognized now because of this full world circumstance we're in?
The business community. You mean the global business community or
the Chamber of Commerce?
Okay. The answer is yes. There are some constraints. And the constraints of natural economic forces as well as the market, those are all in play. Business will not create things that people won't use or buy. But I think business, at least this business person, rejects the catastrophe that Reverend Malthus was talking about, within 30 years the world's population is going to explode, there'll be famine and there'll be pestilence. In the 19th century, the thought was, pretty soon we're just going to, the streets of New York are going to be covered with horse manure. Along came a little idea about an automobile. And then we're not going to be able to see the sun because of telephone lines. The horse manure problem didn't happen. We can see the sun, not today, but it'll come back out. The march of technology and the march of innovation, the march of optimism over fear will prevail. We believe that. Business people believe that. 4 out of 5 businesses fail within 5 years. If business was easy, everybody would do it. The reason people go into business is they're fundamentally optimistic. And the lion's share, 80% of our members are 5 or 10 people or less. It's not the larger corporations.
Ten seconds, Tom. Excuse me.
Do I then answer? No. Are you okay? You.
Okay.
I'm lost.
Well, 2-minute response, please.
Okay, sure. We've got a book club in ASAP now because we've come to view the economic issues as so important. It's been running about 8-9 months called Economics for Spaceship Earth, and we're reading around all sorts of issues, and Dave Shreve is our economist, professional economist who leads it. And one of the things is, in reading around, it seems to many of us there is simply no guarantee that the free market system is either fair in the way it treats people or is either mindful of protecting the environment. If there are resources to be exploited, the free market economy, if it's unfettered, will go ahead and exploit them. And in fact, it's very good at hiding or externalizing lots of costs. And Herman Daly, who I showed the picture of, has called this the invisible foot of the free market economy. So I think, in fact, it does concern me that people say we're optimism and we're not fearful when, in fact, ASAP says we're realists and we're trying to be pragmatic here and not retreat into rhetoric or short-term things that benefit a few but are to the disadvantage of the majority of our residents. Thank you.
So, Tim, you got a 2-minute response?
I worked for a United States congressman in the 70s, and one of my great heroes was Congressman Morris Udall from Arizona. Arizona's politics have changed of late, but he used to say people are in favor of employment; they just don't like employers. And he used to say, "If we could just get our party at the time to stop beating up on employers." So this notion, this incredible notion, Tom, that you said, that capitalism, free market, private enterprise, benefits the few and not the many. There's no question. It benefits some more than others. There's no question about it. It is fundamentally unfair. But I've looked at the other systems in our world from a point of a average guy, and it's far preferable than what I saw when I was in Moscow or other places. So it's just a the benefit of a few. That's an absurd notion.
Okay, 2 minutes response.
What I'd like to suggest, though, let me say, I think that free markets seem to be very good at certain kinds of things, discovering prices of things that are bought and sold, not say so good at discovering value of ecosystem services, which are priceless, but essential, but not sold in the marketplace normally. But it, as he mentioned, it doesn't provide fairness, and it doesn't. It really simply has nothing built into it to consider long-term costs or to consider impacts that have a long lag to them. And what I would say is, I think we've never done a poll of ASAP board members or anything to ask what sort of economic systems do you support. But I think it's fair to say that all of us see a value in free market system up to a point, and that they have to be tempered. And I think the ecological economics thrust says we have to begin explicitly thinking about the limits to the inputs to the systems and the impacts of the outputs on the natural systems. And if we just talk about growth because growth is good, it makes us feel so good, we lose track of this. And we're at a point in the history of the world where this is becoming really dangerous, whereas 50 years ago it was much less dangerous.
Okay, thank you very much. Take a breath. And now each of you will have a chance for an opening, for a closing statement. So, Tim, would you like to go first?
Over lunch, we're talking about where we agree. I think we do agree that there needs to be reasonable regulation of markets, reasonable regulation. Health and safety regulations are critically important. When you pour a glass of milk, you expect it to be free of bad things. When you take something that says ibuprofen, you expect it to be ibuprofen, not cyanide. Those are all important regulations. And similarly with environmental regulations. Environmental regulations should be manageable and obtainable and for the benefit of the larger community. That can be done in a free market system. It is done in a free market system. Free market systems gave us this technology, the phones we're going to use later, our heat in our homes, our electricity, all of that has been driven by free market systems. So I think the common ground we talked about is that, yes, there is a reasonable basis where people of differing points of view can come together and say, these are reasonable regulations. They are not reasonable when they are fundamentally economic regulations disguised as health and safety regulations. And when you say ecological economics, that's a disguise of what I would describe as reasonable regulations.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. Well, first, before I forget, some of you have already picked up the ugly green booklets that were on the table at
I
the
did.
Back. And I saw Tim reading it earlier. If you haven't got one, I think I can see some of the ugly green covers back there still. So please grab one. This is an ASAP book titled Facing the Facts About Growth in Albemarle County, and it summarizes a lot of our arguments. Also, it's got our website address. You can join a listserv and so on and stay in touch. There's email if you want to do that. Please get in touch with us if you find what we're saying interesting. But let me kind of shift to a closing wrap-up. I've talked today about the need to face the facts about growth and that it has impacts that cannot simply go on. We have to face the fact that we exist now in a full world, which a lot of us didn't live in when we were children. And in particular, I've proposed it's time for Charlottesville-Albemarle to try to identify a right size for our community. I'll point out, at times we've responded to very difficult situations, things that took us way out of our comfort zone in our lifetimes. I'm sure most of us in this room can remember World War II. And you wouldn't remember it necessarily, but if you read about it, to deal with the threats of the Axis powers, as they were called when I was a little kid, we had to suddenly rapidly modernize our aircraft. We had to develop a logistic system to support the war in the Pacific in these very far-flung places, and we did it. Later on, in the early days of the space race, son of a gun, we were losing it. Sputnik went up. Yuri Gagarin circled the Earth. We suddenly got very worried. We said, John Kennedy says, we're going to put a man on the moon in just a few years. And doggone it, we did it in, 1969, I think. We would be impressed today if we put a bunch of people on the moon. And in 1969, the fact that we did it is just astonishing. So we can deal with big problems when we recognize they're important to focus on. So the question I have is, can we not face the challenges raised in stabilizing our population? Most of us will, in fact, recall that in the 1960s and 70s, there was really bipartisan support for facing the population explosion, which was of great concern. Now, the willingness to discuss that somehow all went away in more recent years. Nowadays, it's considered almost an unmentionable topic, but we talk about it anyway because we believe it's all become so critical. So we think it's time to get over the idea that population is not something, and population stabilization is not something we dare talk about. Too much is now at stake. And ASAP hopes that you'll agree that it's time for us to begin discussing it locally, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll now go to the questions. I think they've done an excellent job. What about you? Yeah, right. Okay, the first question to both. Why is there a lack of affordable housing in Albemarle and Charlottesville? Recent developments are in the $400,000 range, approaching the price you talked about, I think, Tom. Okay. Dan, would you like to go first?
Sure. There's myriad reasons for that. Interesting, one of the roles I get to do is I get to go to Board of Supervisors meetings and City Council's meeting and Planning Commission meetings. And Tom used the expression "we." It's a great word sometimes. It's a dangerous word other times. But as a community, we put requests, i.e., demands, upon our local government for make sure that there's sidewalks and that there's trees and that there's enough space for the cars to park. I live on Brandywine Drive. It's the widest street, I believe, in the city of Charlottesville. I would like for it to be more narrow. I read Jane Jacobs' book. But we do those things as if it has no impact on the cost of the final product. At different times at these city council and supervisors meetings, they acknowledge, it's a $20,000 per unit profit in Albemarle County to build a house in Albemarle County. If you rezone to have higher density, it's $20,000. The developer doesn't pay that. The homeowner pays that. It's reflected in the price. And so my question has always been to the Board of Supervisors of the City Council, please explain to me, how is it that you're making housing more affordable by making it more expensive? So when you ask government to do something, it comes at a cost. I'm a recovering bureaucrat. I understand the nature of services. And that's what happens. And it's not just Albemarle and Charlottesville. That flu has spread beyond our reaches.
Tom.
Comment. Well, I'm a little bit out of my area of expertise being a biologist, but I've been to a lot of Board of Supervisor meetings. One of the things I can say is, for example, that the cost of proffers, which are things that are offered by builders or developers to be allowed to proceed with the project, which nowadays have morphed kind of into impact fees, sort of, because it used to be something you negotiated individually, but now there's a set policy. The cost of proffers does not cover all of the costs of things like residences. The average cost of public school for one child in Albemarle County is about $13,000 a year. And so the county is actually losing money still with all of that. So the proffer policy is under review right now. It's going to be an interesting discussion. But I will say that there is a general problem. When I've listened to discussions, as I've heard them correctly, developers have often been reluctant to build low-cost houses because they're uncertain that there will be a market for them, or to build low-cost houses near to more expensive houses because that might endanger the value of the upper more valuable, and developers hate uncertainty. I mean, that's something I've heard and heard and heard. So to a degree, the question is, to what degree will local governments insist on that there be low-cost housing or even underwrite low-cost housing? And I think that's a question of trying to keep all of these things in synchronization, and it's the kind of thing that often doesn't get done at just the right rate versus the right amount of demand.
Okay, this one does a little bit of a change of pace, again to both, and it's a little long, so bear with me as I read this one. As more and more commercial and retail space is being built, more and more space stands vacant. There are vacancy signs all over the area. Albemarle Square Shopping Center has been over half empty for years. Is it possible this area will see more urban-suburban blight be overbuilt? The roads and transportation problems are terrible, as witnessed during lunch and rush hour times. Don't know exactly what the question, I guess there is a question in there. Is it possible this area will see more and more urban blight? So comment on empty space and at the same time buildings going up. Tom, take it first.
I can remember about 20 years ago, one member of the Board of Supervisors who was very pro-business saying, well, you know, anybody who knows anything about business knows we're already overbuilt with respect to commercial space. And this was at a time when there was far less commercial space than we have now. And there was a lot of discussion back then about the extent of commercial space we should have, or retail space. Excuse me, I need to be careful about development area zoning designations. There was a lot of discussion about how much retail should we indeed allow, and there was a notion that we should have enough to serve the Albemarle community or the Charlottesville Albemarle and not become a regional center for bringing in people from what we think of as surrounding contiguous, we would call outlying. That depends on where you live. But Albemarle and Charlottesville would view as outlying counties. And my own sense has been that, and I may be wrong, Tim may have much better facts at his fingertips, my own sense is that there's a lot of wish to invest by people outside of this community who think there's a lot of money to be spent here, and it's a good investment to kind of jump into the game, even though it is producing some places which clearly have problems with kind of consistent, persistent vacancies.
The notion, there's not a homogeneous answer there in what I'm going to say. First off, there are different components of what we know as Greater Charlottesville. There's a downtown mall, there's Barracks Road, there's the 29 corridor, there's Pantops, et cetera. And in some places, you will find that the vacancy rate is lower than others. There's you can make the case right now there's a pretty significant vacancy in the premier location, which is Stonefield, because they haven't ramped up yet. But I believe, and I see my buddy Brian McKenzie here, I think in the aggregate we're about 95-97% of the space that's available is full. So that's essentially close to full occupancy because people move and companies move from time to time. As it relates to the traffic, I had a little heartburn getting here, driving over my favorite road, the Parkway, at the intersection. Coming back from upstate New York over the weekend on Monday morning, I had planned everything except the fact that I was traveling on a Monday morning, not on a Sunday morning, and I got to be in the Tappan Zee Bridge queue at 7 o'clock in the morning coming into New York City. We think we have traffic jams here. We actually have traffic jellies. Those things can be fixed, and they should be fixed. We would argue that some things are good and some things are bad, and that's another debate another day. But 97%, 95% occupancy rate is a pretty good number, unless you have the property that is making up the 3%. And so there you do have some places like Albemarle Square, which is struggling, which is going to struggle mightily more when the library moves and when the interchange gets built.
Okay, there are a couple of questions now, one for each of you individually. For Tom Olivier, do you have plans for slowing or stopping in migration without raising the cost of living for those of us who are here?
I guess, well, I've outlined some of the mechanisms that can slow in migration, and I'll just say the two are, for example, easements in the open space. And one of the things that's interesting about easements, and we're hoping to complete a study on it soon, is that many land uses don't pay for themselves because of all the costs associated with them. But as I recall, the open spaces did. And one of the questions is, what is the kind of fiscal value of a conservation easement? Because so much of the, as I say, the budget growth in local government is driven by increases in population. And although one can say, for example, the value of open spaces is recreation and, say, ecosystem services, and the PEC did an analysis of ecosystem services and attached a lot of value to it, although that's kind of hard because they're not really traded. But you could put conservation easements on farms throughout the county and just soak up all sorts of development rights. It's somewhere between 25,000 and 45,000 development rights unbuilt in the rural areas of Albemarle County. I don't think that would greatly increase the cost of living here for people who are already here. And then on the other hand, in terms of in the city, if you start doing things like putting lots of commercial properties near residential neighborhoods, if you start building up density, if you start creating all sorts of additional demand for residences and so on near the city center, I think you're going to see increases in the value of lots of those homes just by the fact that they're now part of this much larger city center. At least that happens in many cities, so long as you don't have urban blight taking place. So, I mean, I would say, in the contrary, in many cases at least, you would be protecting yourself against escalating prices by limiting the number of people that would in-migrate.
Okay, thank you very much. And for Mr. Holbert, is there any point beyond which future growth creates more problems than benefits? Would you like to comment on the previous question?
I'm Irish. I comment anytime I ask.
Okay.
The interesting thing, you know, Albemarle County, 93% of the land of the 700 square miles in Albemarle County is quote-unquote rural by government action. And so in order to build there, you are constricted, and you can build quote-unquote by right. It is much less cumbersome. 7% of Albemarle County, the part that's got the most population, is subject to Albemarle County's extensive permitting and zoning processes. And so, when you do the rezoning, you get hit with that $20,000 per unit proffer. There is no proffer out in the rural area. So if I build 8 houses on the appropriate size a lot in the rural area, I pay zero in terms of proffer, and you have not only the impact, but you have actually more traffic because you're coming farther in to come to work or whatever. In the permitting area, so what that does is that does drive actual development. Tom's correct about 200 units in the rural area. It's just easier to do that, and so we're going to do it in the and so developing community is saying we're going to take the easy path, be in the rural area, because the cost to do this in the development area is exorbitant. That was not the idea when it was passed, 30 years ago. The idea was things would occur in the development area and not in the rural area. And there was, by the way, enormous business consensus for that. So how do you stop immigration? I don't know the answer to that. But if you make prices continue to go up by government regulation and by market forces, the only folks coming into town are going to be people who can afford it. And we've seen some of that already in the last 15 years.
Okay. And here's one for you now, Tim. Is there any point beyond which future growth creates more problems than benefits?
There's an echo. I think I heard that earlier. Mm-hmm. The answer is more problems than benefits. There's no question that there are problems/challenges with growth, and transportation is one of them. We are a society where people want to and have said for the last 80 years, we want to be individually mobile. We want to be able to drive there and be there and have a parking spot, et cetera. And so that becomes, and by the way, you get indoctrinated that when you're a baby. And so that becomes a driver. And how do we can't stand the word sometimes, make decisions that will moderate the negative impacts of population growth, because that's the growth we're talking about. I don't think there's a great argument about economic growth here, but about population growth. And there are some things that need to be done, and I think those are the things where, if it's reasonable and if it's health and safety and not economic regulation, I think there is that common ground that we talked about at lunch.
So, Tom, if you can read the teleprompter, you can answer back.
Well, I think we've already reached the point where there are more problems with growth than advantages. The World Wildlife Fund did an ecological footprint analysis of the planet, which looked at back in 2006, and they tried to estimate per capita consumption of biological outputs versus the productivity of countries around the world. And by their they did the analysis 2006, and by their estimate, the world passed this a sustainable level in terms of human population size and demand sometime in the 1980s. And I saw an allusion recently to the idea that we're now on the way toward needing two planet Earths to support us in a sustainable fashion. And this is with much of the world living in poverty. If we tried to bring them up to our level, if we tried to have them realize the American dream, the demand for resources would go even higher. So we have a problem there. Now, locally, but Weldon Cooper, I think, predicts that our population is supposed to grow by 50,000 by 2040. And given all the change in space, all the new houses in the countryside and so on, do you want that? If you do, would you like to go up to 1 million people here? What is your thought? Are just more and more people okay? I when I was here, Tim cited it when I first came here. Indeed, Albemarle County had 40,000 people. It was really rural down in the Schuyler area, almost. You thought edge of wilderness sort of thing. But what we see, I mean, for example, in the 30 years I've been here, it used to be driving from the south of town, you could get right to the city center in no time. You zipped in from southern Albemarle to the city center. Now, around 64, you start hitting traffic lights. Earlier this week, I think I waited through three light changes to simply get. I was trying to get downtown to a meeting at the county office building. On things like traffic, it's certainly, I don't see any advantage to more growth. I think it's really gone downhill in the last 30 years. We see biologically, I'm on the Natural Heritage Committee, we know of places with rare populations and so on that have disappeared in just really actually just the last few years, and more growth is going to wipe more out. If you look at the study Claire Jantz and James Manuel did, the ASAP Ecosystem Service Study, which is on our website, so visit, you'll see if we continue growing, we're going to lose and lose and lose ecosystem services. And in a world where there are shortages and we rely on the economy bringing us biological outputs from other parts of the world to stay alive, even though we're rich enough to shield ourselves locally from a lot of it, I think there's no question we've already reached the point where more growth is a negative.
Okay, as a wrap-up question, here's the curveball, which is sort of the theme of this whole meeting. I'd like for, now that you've heard each other and you've heard the questions, to see if you can list three items of common ground. What are three things that each of you see that you could agree upon?
It's a trick question.
You go first.
I don't know. We can talk about them one at a time if you like.
Well, I'm having to guess a little bit here, but
just go ahead and guess.
One thing. Well, as Terry knows, a while ago, the Tea Party had a very good meeting last summer on economic development policy, and I attended, as did a bunch of people who just thought it was interesting. And I suggested that ASAP believes that county economic development policy should focus on individuals who are low-income residents to try to provide them with better career paths. And I think a lot of people would, rather than to say provide jobs for high-tech people who, for the most part, are likely to, or many of whom will move here from somewhere else. So I guess that's one area is that good jobs for the low-income people provide education and job career paths, I think we would say. I guess the other side of it is we want an excellent education system. I mean, clearly that's important. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans where the public schools actually were quite awful back in the 1940s and 50s, and that limited the city's economic development. We relied on tourism and oil much too much. And, you know, if you want to have a diversified industry, you need educated people, and that's what I think really brings good companies here and keeps them here. So I would say, I'm going to guess we would agree on at least some of that. And the final thing I say is, we have an extraordinary quality of life here. It's very good, and some of our disagreement, I guess, is what does it take to protect it, or how do you protect it? But I think we have to, you know, Charlottesville and Albemarle, it's a kind of distinct place, and a lot of people either were born here and love it here, or a lot of people came here and love it here, and I think whatever happens, we want to be able to preserve the distinct sense of place that we have here. So those are my tries, Tim.
I had one, now I got six. the Charlottesville Works Program. I got my cards here. Go on our website and look up the Charlottesville Works Initiative. And that is exactly, Tom, that is about giving people a leg up, a pathway out of poverty. And, of course, that begins with a job. The greatest anti-poverty program in the world is a job. The greatest economic development program in the world is a job. We can argue about what they should be, but there's a big chunk of our population that struggles, and I think we can be united for that. And that includes quality of life for everyone in this community. Some of us have more bounty than others, but everybody ought to get a piece of the bounty and a reasonable piece of it. So that would be number one. I think we do agree on some things, and I know in the past 14 years that I've been here, we've been on the same page on some things, and that is reasonable health and safety regulations on our governments and on our businesses. quality of life, we just see it a little bit differently. I see economic vitality and vibrancy as critical. Perhaps you see it as to be feared, but we do want the quality of life to be not only maintained and preserved, I don't like those words, enhanced. And then finally, there is that point in the future, to quote the great philosopher Yogi Berra, that we get to that point where nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded. And I don't know where that point is. I think it's further away than what you think it is. But there is a point, and it's not for government deciding that there should be 165,000 of us, because I don't know where those 21,000 extra people are going to be or who gets to decide who comes in. But I do think that there is a point where we need to try and be ahead of the congestion and ahead of the issues. I don't know which projects we'll end up supporting together, but I think there's some common ground there.
Thank you very much. What do you think?
Great job. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.